Today is July 24th, the year 2000. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Lawrence Summers for Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial to be commemorated 5 years from now in the year 2005. Dr. Summers, you can see we're tape recording this session. Do you give us permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to start first with your educational and professional background. Where did you go to school, and how did you ultimately end up at Michigan State?
A bachelor's degree at University of Wisconsin, a master's at University of Wisconsin, and PhD at Northwestern University. So within the Big Ten.
Mm-hmm. Were you born in Wisconsin?
I was born in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. What year was your BA?
BA was in 1943. Yeah, 43. And MA was in when I got back from the war in 1946, and PhD in 1950.
Okay. We've asked all the veterans that we've interviewed, where did they serve and what units were you in?
I served in North Africa and Italy. I was trained as an infantryman, but actually, because at the camp I was in Northern Africa, the head of the postal unit was interested in getting somebody who had a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I was apparently the only one there. While I was there, about 2,000 of us went over as replacements. This is the time Oromo was making big progress in North Africa. And most of my buddies actually were injured or killed, and I was still waiting in the pool, and finally got into this post unit and stayed with it actually during the whole war. Went from North Africa to Italy and all the way up the peninsula of Italy with the 5th, right behind the 5th Army.
Mm-hmm. So General Clark's?
General Clark, right. Mm-hmm.
Then when you got out, did you use the GI Bill for your graduate work?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was. I had trained to be a high school teacher at Wisconsin, actually.
In what field?
In geography.
In geography.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And social science.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the GI Bill that brought me into a PhD program, actually, and the reason I'm here, actually, mm-hmm. rather than someplace else.
Did you have any high school teaching experience, ultimately, or
nothing.
Because of
the
war?
Well, just practice teaching.
I see. And then because of the war, went on to that. What was your area of interest or your dissertation in at Wisconsin?
The dissertation was, I did it on the fishing industry in a county in western Norway, which is also an interesting. I was going to do a study on the harbor of Milwaukee. And a professor from the University of Oslo came through Northwestern and found I was of Norwegian ancestry, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so we chatted, and he had a project in Western Norway. And so I got some support from him and also from the Social Science Research Council and the American Scandinavian Foundation, and ended up in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you speak Norwegian?
I do now.
Oh, you
do? I learned it, actually.
I see.
I was there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
and learned language.
Mm-hmm.
And have been going back ever since.
Mm-hmm.
I've made probably 24 or 25 trips back to Norway since that first one.
Wow. Who in your family emigrated? How far back?
My mother and father both immigrated.
Oh, they did? Yeah. Oh, so you're second generation?
First generation. First generation.
I see.
Right.
Uh-huh. And they came right to Wisconsin?
They came to Wisconsin, yes.
The what part of Norway did they come from?
They came from, my father was from 30 miles south of Oslo, my mother about 65 miles northwest of Wisconsin, of Oslo.
Oslo,
and my mother was about 65 miles northwest of Oslo.
Mm-hmm. When you went back, did it meet your expectations, or the first time you were in Norway?
Well, I think most people that have immigrated, they tend to look at the big, bright things, you know, the things that they remember, the positive things. And in that sense, it wasn't quite as, the strawberries weren't quite as big, the apples, apples weren't quite as rosy as they described them to them, you know, after they'd been here for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it was sort of a disappointment. But I stayed with relatives over there and had a marvelous time with the family. And they helped me learn Norwegian, actually, because they couldn't speak English, so I had to.
So you had to. Sounds like the best teachers.
I learned Norwegian, actually. I never had a course in the grammar of Norwegian, and learned the vocabulary by reading the daily newspaper. And talking with my uncle Lang, aunt, and their son, who I got to be very close to, actually.
How did you approach your dissertation? Did you interview fishermen, or did you use data, or
I used both.
What's the combination?
I interviewed fishermen, and became quite well acquainted, actually, with a number of them. Mm-hmm. I would start out to. They would start out to English. Most of them actually can speak English over there. And somewhere along the line, the conversation was switched to Norwegian. And it was always a satisfaction to me to get them to switch to Norwegian.
Ah.
So said I was doing pretty well in that language. it was an excellent experience.
What was your main discovery as a result of your dissertation?
Well, it was
your main thesis.
Primarily the distribution of the various kinds of products and how they were marketing them. And there was one product in particular, the clipfish, which is a dried cod, which is a very distinct product, which at that time was actually dried on rocks, sun-dried, air-dried. Now they're doing it actually with mechanically or with artificial heat. And the major finding was the degree of support that fishing was giving to various parts. Geography is interested in distribution of things. And what I came up with then was a distribution of the various aspects of the fish industry in that section, which emphasized the catching of herring, which is a very temperamental fish in terms of it actually disappears from the coast, and at that time actually it was quite abundant.
Were you able to publish any of
Yes, published several articles. Articles out of it.
How was it that you ultimately came to Michigan State?
Well, I had made the normal applications in, to various institutions. There were three that were I was a candidate for. It was the University of Nebraska, Rutgers University, and Michigan State. And I was invited here for an interview, and I liked it very much. And so we made an agreement.
The rest is history.
The rest is history.
It's interesting. So you were basically here your whole career.
I was here my whole career, actually. I was here as a faculty member and on up chair of the department and then eventually assistant provost for a period of 40 years. And now I've served 50 years.
When you first came, did you realistically think you were going to stay? Or was there a point in your career where you said, well, I guess I'm going to stay here?
Well, there were several chances for me to move elsewhere. But when I came down to looking at the considerations, actually, I was able to be moved forward to a better position, and was recognized here very rapidly, actually, as a, from assistant professor to associate with tenure, and then at that time also became chair of the department, and had the chance to grow and develop a department here from almost nothing to one of the major departments in the country. So, in essence, the opportunities for growth were here. I didn't have to move, as many people do, to other institutions in order to get promotions. the opportunities were here. We were a growing institution, as you well know. About 15,000 when I came, and grew rapidly from there up to very shortly up into the 30s and 40,000 students.
When you first came, what were some of your first impressions? Obviously, Wisconsin and Northwestern being Big Ten schools, maybe the MSU wasn't part of the Big Ten then, right?
No, it wasn't a part of the Big Ten.
But what were some of your early impressions, if you remember anything about you when you first arrived?
I was impressed by the area being open and actually very attractive. I interviewed here in the spring, and the flowers around here are as pretty as you can find anywhere. It's just a tremendously beautiful campus in the spring. So I was impressed by the campus. I was impressed. It was a geology and geography department at that time. And the chair of the department was a geologist by the name of Bergquist. And he made he actually was also very interested in geography. So there was a sort of a rapport that developed between that person and myself. And I interviewed with Dean Emmons, which is one of the early science and arts deans here. And he was a very, very influential and persuasive individual. Interviewed over in Morrill Hall, where we were as a department there, and moved that fall that I arrived, moved into the new natural science building. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any early contacts with President Hanna?
My contacts with President Hanna actually were not very close. Mm-hmm. We were sort of aware with one another, but there wasn't really much opportunity. President Hanna actually was a kind of an administrator who didn't really need the close contact with faculty and didn't really develop it very well. I remember, one incident which sort of illustrates this. Truman was developing the Point 4 program, which in various parts of the world. And we wrote a letter to him saying, as geographers, actually the world is what we study, and we would like to assist him and work with him in any way that was useful. And his reply was, I expect you to do that. So there was no need actually to contact him. But he was a tremendous administrator and developed this institution in a way which wouldn't have happened, certainly not as quickly as it did, without his capabilities and his degree of ability to work with the legislature, work in terms of developing the campus, both with its physical nature and academically. One of the outstanding presidents, actually, of the 20th century, I think, in higher education.
Mm-hmm. What, in dealing with the issue of the geology geography department, at what point did it go into separate?
It split in 1955.
Okay. And you were chair at that time?
No.
Or you were?
I was the first chair of the department.
Okay.
And it's sort of an interesting story because I was sort of the young Turk in the campus, in the department. And I expected one of the senior professors would become the chair. I was very surprised that I was called in to Dean Emmons. Well, actually, by that time it had been Milton Milder was in the deanship of science and arts. So Milder and Kimber, or Harry Kimber from history, I don't know whether you ever came across him.
I don't think he was here when I I came in 78.
No, he probably was gone by that time. Mm-hmm. So they offered me the headship at that time, and I took a night without sleep to consider it and finally decided, well, I'll give it a try. And it worked out very well.
Do you remember when you took over as chair, how many faculty did you have?
There were five of us.
Five, okay. Yeah. And then did it expand to what size?
At one point, we're up to 22. Mm-hmm.
So you were able to, so the department's history kind of reflects the general history of the university at that time.
Well, we grew a little faster than that, I think. We were five, as I said, and we had a master's degree in 55, and we were brash enough to suggest a PhD program, and we got that approved in 57. Mm-hmm. And I grew actually to one of the leading 10 or 15 departments with PhDs in the country by the 1960s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm. What was the area, was there any particular area of specialty that the department really excelled in within geography?
Well, very strong in land use evaluation, and also in physical geography we're quite strong. Looking at the physiography and the topography and its arrangement, distribution, and importance. Mm-hmm. So physical geography, economic geography, and then in certain regions of the world. We had strength and very strong in the geography of Africa. I was teaching the geography of Europe, and we had two people who were teaching in the geography of Asia. So regional geography was very strong at that time. And the systematic and more topical emphasis has developed more recently. And we had a very strong techniques, especially in remote sensing and cartography. Remote sensing was taught by the geologists and geographers here during World War II to service people. Mm-hmm. So we had a very strong airfoil interpretation program, which subsequently was called remote sensing. Has continued to be a strength even now in the geographic information system and the computer arrangements and developing. This was developed all by hand when I did it back in 1977. We're now revising that, and the maps are entirely drawn by computer.
Into this, for the benefit of the transcribers, the Atlas of Michigan.
The Atlas of Michigan.
So done pretty much without computer.
That was done entirely by hand. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a computer at that time. Mm-hmm. We employed 31 students at various degrees of competence, actually, to work with us in terms of the technical aspects of the cartography, supervised by faculty. And I think it also has serves, at least at that time, maybe still, has been the project that involved most wide distribution of faculty and students over the entire university.
It sounded like a real collaborative effort.
It was a real collaborative effort. There were over 30 faculty from various departments. We had people writing sections of it. When you got to history, we had Madison Kuhn, mm-hmm. and all over the campus, and we picked out specialists to help us with the areas that they were familiar with.
And they're doing a new version, a high-tech version?
That's underway now. I'm mm-hmm. serving as a senior consultant, and it's actually being developed in three different phases. They're just completing now a CD-ROM version, mm-hmm. which will be used in education here and throughout the state, and hopefully in the school systems. Then there will be a web that's in the process, so that information will be readily available through the web. And then we hope to do the paper-bound volume for the centennial, mm-hmm. or the sesquicentennial in 2005.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of our faculty members are Native American, and they're involved with the Native American aspects of that. They have some detailed maps and personal knowledge from background from some of the Michigan tribes.
Right.
Let's talk about maybe some of your own teaching. You mentioned that you had you taught the Geography of Europe class.
I taught the Geography of Europe class.
Did you teach during your entire career in terms of administration? Or?
I made sure that I kept teaching so I didn't lose that ability. Even when I was full-time assistant dean of international programs at one time. When I was chair, I always taught one or two courses a year, if not more. And when I was in the provost's office, I actually continued to teach at least one course a year.
Mm-hmm. What do you think value that teaching experience gives to an administrator?
Well, it gives you touch, gets you in touch with the basic purpose of the institution, is to try to educate our young people to the best of our ability. And if you're going to administer, you need to know what's going on with one of the major functions of the institution, which is teaching. And it also then, keeping up with it means that you shouldn't stay an administrator forever. And when you stop, if you haven't done it, you have to retool yourself, actually. But if you keep at it, you just increase the emphasis a little bit and keep going.
What was your favorite technique for getting students to learn and think about geography? Did you have any particular favorite method?
Well, drawing on the background of the students themselves as to where they came from, and then trying to get them to see, based on the viewpoint of geography, what are the areas that they were born or where they went to school, or the total composition of a class provided you actually with a great deal of personal expertise, but they didn't really know how to put it together. And I think one of the things that that geography has a role to play is trying to present and understand how the physical and the cultural things fit together, and the reasons for them being as they are, and trying to understand the sense of place. So, in the Europe course, I would draw on those that had some experience in traveling in Europe, and in other courses, I would draw on. I taught economic geography actually, along with the Europe, and then also the theory and philosophy of the discipline. That's what was primarily for majors and graduate students. So one of the things that's real difficult for geography, and actually to some extent is also true of history, that the history and geography of an area is so commonplace. They've lived in it for many years, but they don't understand how to put it together and try to explain why it is as it is, because the characteristics are entirely different from place to place. And this understanding place, understanding the nature of place and how it's developed and what the importance of that kind of arrangement is. I went to a lecture one time by an Indian from a tribe in Canada, and he was emphasizing how the Indians developed a sense of place and how important it was actually in their development and their survival and their ability to use the resources that they had in the areas in which the tribes were located. And it's that kind of a relationship between the cultural and the economic and the political and the social conditions with the physical environment, how that works together and how why it is as it is and how important that is actually in understanding what places are like in the various parts of the world.
Did you use family history, encourage students to bring that in any
yes,
way, or
yeah.
in terms of their European, or so many of them probably
right.
had European, Western European background?
We used their background, and actually a number of them had taken trips mm-hmm. to Europe, which we would draw on. And I would use, I just have thousands of slides, actually, which I've taken over the, and I used a lot of slides in illustrating what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And in the economic geography, which I taught five sections of it, a quarter when I first came.
Five sections.
Of the same course. And that was the last section was a trying experience, actually.
You probably taught it entirely differently yeah. than at first.
Well,
you
stop in different places too. You know, you don't make the same progress, so you have to know where you left off in that section the last time you taught it. But I grew up on a farm actually, and we had a small dairy farm in southern Wisconsin, so we had some cash crops in order to make a go, especially during the recession. And tobacco was one of them. And I used to use tobacco as an illustration of the degree of labor that was involved in farming. Because it's one of the most labor-intensive crops, mm-hmm. actually, that you can find. So I would draw on my own experience, actually, in terms of where that fitted into the nature of economic geography.
In looking at the students and their preparation, did you see difference in what they came to with their understanding of geography from the beginning of your career until later on?
Actually, it was continued to be a problem to get them to understand really the major purpose of the discipline was to think about the understanding of what places are like. You can memorize things, and this is mostly what happened when geography was taught in secondary schools,
mm-hmm.
In primary schools, actually, at the time. But to really get them to understand the purpose and the what actually geography brings to understanding, that's been difficult to get across, and still it's the same problem, actually.
Mm-hmm. In looking at your international experience, we talked a little bit about that. Did
sure.
you have any Fulbright professorships or any sabbatical where you traveled? What were some of those?
Well, the first, when I was there in Norway for a year, as I said before, that was supported by the American Scandinavian Foundation and the Social Science Research Council. I had a fellowship from both of those to support my work there for a year. And then it was the Office of Naval Research. I was involved early with the geographic office of the Office of Naval Research. And they had a committee on which I served for 3 years, which was to help guide the geographic components of that office in Washington, D.C. And they supported half a year, and this was in Denmark at that time, in 1953. And then after I became chair of the department, there is the policy that an administrator can take 3 months leave every 3 years rather than every half or a full year, every mm-hmm. seventh year. And I took that religiously.
Mm-hmm.
Every 3 years, I would go off to Europe
mm-hmm.
during the summer and leave the department to somebody else here during that period. So I supported myself, actually, by, I used my salary during that period for travel rather than I've been to Europe, and especially to Scandinavia, on several occasions where they would invite me for a period of a few weeks to a few months, and that's happened 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that with a particular university, or it varied?
It varied, yeah. Actually, that's continued up to the present. I was invited just a few weeks ago to Sweden to give a lecture as part of a honor that was being given to one of my Swedish colleagues, where he got a prize which was given to him by the Anthropology and Geography Association, actually delivered by the King of Sweden. And he had a chance to invite, this is the person, Professor Bielund, to invite four people from various parts of the world to participate in a seminar, which he was supposed to develop after the presentation of this medal. And I was one of the people that was invited to participate, which was a very, very nice affair.
Had you known him for many?
I'd known him for quite a while, yeah. He's from northern Sweden, and